Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Food Disruptors, an IFT podcast that brings you the latest insights and perspectives from some of the brightest minds in the science of food. Each episode, our guests discuss the ever-changing intersection of entrepreneurship, innovation, and science, and their role in advancing our global food system. This week, we'll take a look at research and development in the industry and the years of planning, developing, and prototyping that goes into making a new food product. We'll also dive into the future of food and some of the most promising R&D initiatives in the marketplace. I'm your host, Matt Teagarden, and today we're joined by the judges, mentors, and supporters of IFT's IFT Next 2018 Food Disruptors Challenge. This competition helps emerging and investment-ready food companies by providing mentorship and visibility to further their positive impact on our global food supply. Let's welcome Evan Hyman, Director of Emerging Business at Ingredion Incorporated, Justin Schimmick, CEO and CTO at Matson, Natalie Schmulek, CEO of The Hatchery Chicago, and Lenny Leibovich, founder and CEO of Bree Brands. Thanks for being with us today, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So all of you work with startups and entrepreneurs in different capacities. So let's maybe run through the list here and provide our listeners with some background on your expertise and how each of you work with startups and other companies. Evan, let's start with you.
Great. Well, Matt, thanks so much. And thanks for having me. Really excited to share today and be in this great discussion. So I guess personally, I've been around food and beverage for well over 20 years now, working for some large consumer brands, ingredients, all the way to the store shelf, working primarily in marketing, business development, and strategy roles. I've been with Ingredion for about 6 years now, working in a variety of different sort of startup roles, and specifically as far as how Ingredion works with entrepreneurs. For those of you who don't know, Ingredion is a Fortune 500 food ingredient company. And so we started our emerging business initiative last year, particularly to work with smaller startup brands, because one of the big challenges you have as an ingredient company is servicing and working with smaller companies, because a lot of the times, you know, many smaller entrepreneurs don't realize that they can actually get help from companies like ours. So I'm sure we'll get much more into it later, but I think that's where I'd like to start.
Excellent. Justin, how about you?
Yeah, thanks, Matt. So as a company, Matson's been in business for about 40 years. And we're a food and beverage innovation company. So we work across all food and beverage. We work with companies of all sizes. And, you know, for startups, often we're engaged, you know, very early on, sometimes right at that point where they get their first investment and are just incubating their idea. I think what we find is that when we work with the startup community, that a lot of times the innovation objectives, you know, are the same. You know, we have to find a killer idea that's human-centered. We have to execute it really well. Food startups, by their very nature, are nimble and agile. Sometimes what they need is more discipline, and especially when it comes to food safety and quality. You know, those are things that they learn on their journey to scale. So where we're positioned is often right at that nexus between bigger CPG and these nimble food startups. And often our role is to accelerate them along their way and educate as they need to be. But everything we do, we do for them.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm already starting to see some of the different perspectives we have coming in. Natalie, let's move on to you.
Thank you for having me. So The Hatchery Chicago is a nonprofit food and beverage incubator. And what we do is really specialize in providing multiple resources to food and beverage entrepreneurs at every stage. We try to match three primary areas of need. So those being access to production space, access to resources, and access to financing. We're building a new facility in East Garfield Park on the west side of Chicago. This will be a 67,000 square foot food and beverage manufacturing space that houses 56 private food grade production spaces that are modular, a shared kitchen space, co-working and office space, event and ideation space, a culinary training center, and then one of our parent companies, Axion, will be moving their headquarters to this facility to provide access to early stage financing. So they provide microloans to entrepreneurs who aren't quite yet bankable. We right now run a curriculum, which we've been running for about 3 years. And this curriculum really focuses in on those challenges that entrepreneurs face and how to accelerate growth, launch your business, grow your business. And we cover all sorts of topics from starting a food business when you're just thinking about the concept, all the way through to growth, distribution, access to financing, access to buyers, distributors. And so we specialize in a very holistic approach, not just providing technical services, but also providing support, whether it be building company culture and also assisting you with finding the right talent, retaining that talent, and understanding various HR practices throughout.
That's incredible. And Lenny, how about giving us a little bit of background on yourself and Pre-Brands?
Great. Thank you for having me today. So Lenny Leibovich, founder and CEO of Pre-Brands. We are a consumer products company innovating in the fresh space. Today we are focused on premium consumers in the fresh beef category. We have, scaled ourselves through both angel and venture capital through multiple rounds. We've gotten pretty good recognition in the industry for kind of being a disruptor and being category captain within the industry. But essentially what we're doing is we're bringing a consumer-centric approach to a really important consumer category in fresh food. And fresh is where, you know, we think a lot of the opportunity is and is historically not the domain of consumer-driven CPG companies. So we view ourselves as innovating, kind of a consumer-driven business model in premium fresh foods. I started my career, I was an investment banker and an equity analyst early in my career, ended up going into business and corporate development roles across telecommunications and technology, and I've spent more than a decade in the food business around meat. And so I view myself as bringing kind of a very different perspective to a category that hasn't really evolved much for a long time. And on the side, I love to kind of mentor entrepreneurs, particularly around food and beverage, and trying to help them solve some of their problems. And what I find is that being able to kind of help other people solve their problems allows me to kind of take a break from many of my own problems and maybe come back at them and solve them more creatively. And I've seen some of the ups and downs of entrepreneurs and, you know, some of the challenges they have that, you know, I've faced in the past and, you know, helped solve. So love to provide that feedback to people and then get to kind of hear different, completely different things that I'm not familiar with and try to help help folks come to the right answers and move their businesses forward. So appreciate the opportunity to be here and, you know, kind of, you know, share some perspective.
Well, excellent. I'm just so glad that we have such interesting perspectives on the on this episode talking about startups, because, you know, it's really interesting and seems almost kind of out of reach sometimes to start a food startup. And there's a lot that goes into it, but the projects can be super, super interesting. And really, you all must have seen some interesting projects at all ends of the spectrum and with the different groups that you've worked with. And I was curious if any of you could share a little bit about something that you're working on right now that might have a lot of potential. Justin, I don't know if you have any examples you can share.
Sure. You know, and I think, with this area of plant-based is certainly continuing to grow. One of the things that I like to say here at Madsen is that we've been doing plant-based innovation before it was cool. So, 25 years ago when this product Qorn, Q-U-O-R-N, came to the U.S., we were involved in helping figure out how to position that to consumers as a mycoprotein. And so that's continued. Recently in April, we convened a plant-based summit where we brought together other startups in the Bay Area that are working on next generation of plant-based foods. And I think what's really interesting is that as this space, you know, continues to evolve, especially over the last 5 years where you've had a lot of food tech and other technology from outside the traditional food industry come in, the products themselves are now becoming those that are not just only disrupting, you know, meat and dairy and eggs, but are starting to become a little bit more nuanced and find their ways into every part of our shopping cart. So, you know, my prediction is that, you know, these types of products that are fueled by plants and even cellular agriculture will continue to evolve, and you'll just see more and more of them in more places.
And when you say cellular agriculture, do you mean things like lab-grown meat, for instance?
Yep, lab-grown meat, but also dairy and eggs, proteins that are produced more from traditional fermentation type of technologies that have been around a long time. I think it's an area where, you know, consumer acceptance is growing. We actually had some data on that where, you know, you might assume that some of, you know, consumers have a problem with some of these products, but I think there's an interest level, and at least for a specific demographic, there's a pull and an interest that I think will continue to fuel R&D efforts.
Interesting. Very cool. Natalie, what's an example of something that you've seen before?
So we've definitely seen a lot of innovation in the food tech space. Some of our member companies are Farmer's Fridge and Tovala, which are finding new unique ways to utilize technology so that they can create more nutritious foods, as well as allow for more individuals to access these foods in areas that traditionally they wouldn't have been able to access them. Alongside that, we're definitely seeing a lot of focus on functionality, and a lot of our members are really starting to ride with the wave of elixirs and shrubs and botanics. And I think a lot of the innovation is also coming from the brand strategy and marketing, even the packaging design. We're seeing a lot of unique innovations there. And then on top of that, something that we're working on with our new facility is really creating an environment that encourages collaboration so that multiple companies can actually work together. Alongside our partner Ingredion, who Evan is here today, we hosted a culinology event, which really helped to provide additional insights on unique ingredients and products that some of our entrepreneurs may have not been introduced to early on. And in this way, they're able to start opening their minds to new ingredients and new applications for these ingredients and work with their fellow entrepreneurs to start developing unique items that they can together launch in the market. So that's something we're really excited to see moving forward.
That's really neat. And I love that you called out too that you're seeing innovation in sort of all parts of the food product. It's not necessarily just the food itself, but also in the packaging and marketing approach. And I know I personally have been noticing that more and more as I'm shopping at the supermarket. Lenny, how about you? What's going on at Pre-Brands?
Well, I mean, we're obviously kind of innovating in the fresh beef category today. We, you know, have our hands full with that. It's a large category. It's complicated. Perishability makes things that much more challenging. I would say the cultural legacies of the category, if you were to kind of walk into a grocery store and take a snapshot of 1950 of the different categories and take a snapshot today, I would argue that you'd have seen the least progress in the beef category of any category in the store. So I think there's a lot of opportunity to bring a consumer mindset to that category. And I have a lot of understanding around why there hasn't been a lot of evolution. But I would say that in general, more broadly, is that I think that there's going to be a lot more innovation and fresh. You know, one of the things that having done Expo West for the first time this past year, you know, something that kind of I noticed is that in general, there's thousands of vendors. But in terms of kind of, let's call it real food, foods that our grandparents or great-grandparents would recognize, there's not a lot of that. There's a lot of processed stuff, a lot of formulated stuff, but not a lot of real fresh food, which is, I think, where consumers are going. And there's only so much room for, let's call it, so many jerkies or cold brew coffees or snack bars or whatever it may be. So I think that there's going to be a lot more in terms of kind of maybe single ingredient or, you know, kind of simple fresh foods. And I think one of the other things that I think is we're going to see more of is more of a focus on kind of taste and eating experience of the products. I think there's a lot of products that exist in the market that have had some success that I think have had success within a segment that is interested in the health benefit or the performance. But as they're seeking kind of broader application and broader kind of, let's call it, demand, you know, they're going to have to kind of address the kind of the eating experience or taste piece. And I'd say that we've kind of gone from food that went from, let's call it food 1.0, which is kind of food, or you know, call it food 0.0, which is food 1.0, which is called the industrialization of food, Food 2.0 is the deindustrialization of food. And I think that we're going to kind of find that the next generation is going to be more natural versions that actually taste really good to kind of be able to attract more consumer adoption.
Fascinating. And Evan, what's going on at Ingredion in terms of some things that have a lot of potential?
Sure. Well, I'm going to take a bit of a different tact on this question because, I mean, when we started our emerging business initiative, part of it was making sure we have a team that can interact with a lot of these entrepreneurs. So one of the things that I was really pushing my team to do, and we're just starting to do it now, is trying to get a view on how are different companies starting to use our ingredients in different formulations? What are the kinds of requests that we're getting? So if you're looking at something, to utilize a starch ingredient or a sweetener ingredient, what kind of application, what kind of requests are we getting? And actually, that's actually helping us get a view on trends in the marketplace. So I can actually give you a couple of examples of things that we're seeing. So for example, not so dramatically different than the plant-based trend, so to speak, but meat and cheese type products that utilize our ingredient, that whole plant-based dairy. So we're seeing a lot of requests for our ingredients that go into those types of products. We're getting a lot of requests for our ingredients that go into things with cannabis, clean label confectionery, organic sweeteners, clean label emulsifiers. So a lot of the types of things that you're hearing in the marketplace, whether they're clean label, plant-based, and as I said, something like cannabis, it's interesting because our ingredients are being used in this and it gives us a point of view where it doesn't just help inform us. It actually makes us think about how do we look at our innovation, the kinds of ingredients that we're going to offer to the marketplace, whether they're organic or non-GM or plant-based products, because obviously, you know, you're getting these kinds of requests from entrepreneurs, from startups. Primarily, my team is dealing with smaller companies and we get requests digitally. We get requests via trade shows and other things. And it's interesting in my 6+ years at this company, how the evolution has changed as to what those types of requests are and how people utilize the ingredients that we have in our portfolio. And very clear, we position ourselves and make sure we can launch the types of ingredients that are on trend, whether it's clean label or things that can be used in plant-based. So those are just a couple of things that we see. And those are very specifically based on the kinds of opportunities that we see people using our ingredients with. So I hope that helps and answers your question, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're definitely in a really interesting position in that you're trying to anticipate some of these unique, innovative, and disruptive needs. But you also have this great emerging business part that helps you kind of get some insight into that. So that's a really fascinating position to be in.
Yeah, I mean, we're excited about it because at the end of the day, we want to be able to interact and we realize it's not as simple as here's an ingredient, go buy it, right? You got to make sure that it's on trend and people want it. And, you know, we do a lot of consumer research to make sure that, you know, the types of thing that Justin talked about earlier in terms of innovation, we have to be on top of that. So it's really, you know, for a large company like ours, it's making sure that we can ensure that we're dealing with the right partners, folks like the Hatchery and connecting with a lot of different brands. So we're excited about it and, you know, excited about sharing some of the insights that we get on calls and podcasts like this.
And so I want to move on to talk a little bit also about the business side of it and a little bit of the process innovation or the product innovation side of things. So Natalie, Justin, and Evan, you all work with a lot of different businesses that impact the food industry. And when growing a business, there's all these buzzwords, like cash flow, obviously, team management, customer success. But what role does innovation really play? So when someone comes up with an idea for a startup, they might have an idea for one great product. But can that one product stand the test of time? Or do they need to be continuously evolving their product line over time? So Natalie, maybe let's start with you.
Sure. So I think one thing that we try to make sure our entrepreneurs and members are aware of is that it is important to adapt and stay relevant, but you don't want to create for the sake of creating. There has been a lot of success with companies who've launched one really strong product, and they can continue to grow and advance and develop through other forms of innovation. As mentioned earlier, sometimes it's a matter of innovating the product through packaging or even portion size. We've seen a lot of companies try to stay relevant by understanding consumer needs, and that's essential. And what we're seeing a lot more right now is that customers are demanding portion size. So they want a one serving size per packet. So a lot of these companies are launching smaller product lines, new packaging that's much clearer, much more transparent in terms of what's going into the product. Sometimes it's a matter of making your product a little bit more convenient. Maybe it has a new social mission connected to it, so you're using compostable packaging, or you're supporting a cause. So there's a lot of different ways to make sure that you are staying in front of your customer and you are staying relevant without necessarily having to launch new product lines. But in the same sense, there are ways to continue and extend your product line and find other product extensions that actually relate to the brand as a whole. So you want to be careful if you are launching a new product not to jeopardize the brand. It should really stay in tune with what your company and your business stands for. But we've seen that kind of success with companies like Barnana, where Barnana launched originally just one dehydrated banana snack, and then they saw there was an opportunity to do chocolate and peanut butter coated snacks, and then chips, and then plantain chips. So that extension really made sense, and it still connected with their same consumer, but allowed them to increase their purchasing by adding additional items from that brand. So I think there is innovation plays a variety of forms, and sometimes it's even adding more nutrients to your product. We see some companies looking for ways to up the protein content, reduce the carbohydrates, reduce the sugars. So I think it's important, but it should first and foremost come from what consumer demand is and listening to your customer and then developing those innovations from there.
Well, I think that's a great callback to that holistic approach that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, this is Justin. I very much agree and echo that. I think, the consumers themselves are always changing and evolving. And so by the very nature of that fact, products and brands need to evolve. And so, big iconic brands, they need to continue to take their product forward, often fixing things that are no longer, contemporary food values. So moving to nutritional upgrades, cleaning up the labels. But then as Natalie mentioned, even in the startup world, which I think this is core to how they operate, they are very, nimble and agile and willing to pivot. And so as you continue to evolve your proposition continuously, it can always be a work in progress, but really a work in progress in service of making sure that you're always delivering what this evolving consumer wants and needs. And so I think innovation is core and just is a fact of every business. If you don't innovate and you just optimize and cost optimize, your business will be short-lived.
Evan, do you have any thoughts to add there?
I mean, I absolutely echo everything that's been said. I think the only other thing that I would say is that while innovation is core, and it's obviously a role that we always play, one of the things that startups, and I've seen this quite a few times, is that sometimes startups do get a little off mission, get off track sometimes. They're so focused on what's the next new thing, and they lose track of what's actually trying to drive their business. So it's having that healthy balance between really trying to drive your business. As Natalie mentioned, innovation can be packaging. Could it also be, let's get a new way to demo our product in the store, right? And, because at the end of the day, product has to move off the shelf if it's a retail product. So I would just say that I've seen it a few times where some entrepreneurs are a little bit all over the place, and making sure that you're core to what your mission is, and then layering on innovation, meaning some level of new product development, whether it's packaging, ingredients, or what have you, on top of that, and doing it in a thoughtful and purposeful manner, and knowing that when is the time to pivot is very important, because it does get to be very challenging where, a company like ours, we deal with entrepreneurs all the time who are looking for different ingredients, and, you're on a call, and then one person said the founder slash chef slash, bookkeeper, because they're all the same thing, right? They say they want an ingredient for one thing, and then they move to something else the next week. So obviously that's challenging for anybody to deal with from our perspective. But more importantly, how successful can a company be? Because it's more likely that startups are going to fail, right? So you want to be able to support them and be as successful as possible. So one of the things that we'll often do is we'll share some of the market research maybe that we'll have around maybe why you might want to look at a clean label ingredient for something like this and how it hopefully fits in with your mission. But, we're a little bit farther back in the supply chain in terms of how companies will deal. That being said, stick to core mission and realize innovation plays a role because everyone's always looking for something new, but don't get too off track, I guess is what I would add.
And so Lenny, along this same train of thought, what are some of the obstacles that you've seen for business innovation in both big and small companies?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm just speaking to more of the challenges that we've kind of faced as a business. So you've kind of touched on some of them. I think cash flow is a real concern for businesses and being able to build in proper working capital management into your business from the outset is really important. I think a lot of people maybe underestimate that, but being able to kind of pay your vendors, in longer time frame and collect faster, even if it comes at a cost, is, you know, generally I think a good thing for startups. But say that the biggest challenge we face is that, you know, there are generally incumbents that are wedded to existing business models and they're successful with those business models. And to the extent you want to come in and change how a category does business or how certain customers do business within a category, you're going to face a lot of kind of cultural challenges and, you know, organizational challenges and just a lot of human psychology that is more comfortable with the status quo than something that they don't fully understand. So it's that just going into something and understanding the degree of resistance that you're likely to face if it's something is really, really new is probably something that I underappreciated and I find others underappreciate as well. And, you know, kind of tying that into kind of a capital, you know, from the capital perspective is that, you know, people early on would say, well, just assume it's going to take you twice as long and cost you twice as much. And I would say those people were being pretty nice about it. I think it's going to likely cost you more than twice as much and likely take you more than twice as long. And being able to kind of set your own expectations properly, which will allow you to set the expectations of others either inside your company or outside the company properly, I think would really behoove a startup, because I think that there's a big expectations management game that you're playing as an entrepreneur, because you need to bring a lot of people along to, you know, to basically be interested in your vision and kind of support what you're trying to accomplish. And being able to manage all those external relationships and manage their expectations, I think is really critical to success.
I think that's really great insight. I want to maybe take a step back in this whole process though for a second. So, you know, we've discussed a little bit about, you know, having this great idea and evolving it over time in different ways. But first, you know, you have to have that great idea in order to bring it to life. And so, Justin, you mentioned earlier that Matson does a little bit of idea generation often when it's working with startups and other companies. And so I'm curious if you could share a little bit about how your team really goes about coming up with these new innovative ideas.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Yeah, for us, there's definitely not a one-size-fits-all approach. We have a number of what I would almost call tools or techniques where we'll collaboratively engage with our clients to really figure out the next new big thing. And often the idea is to diverge as much as you can, get a lot of ideas out on the table, and then later come back and converge in on a few platforms that you can either, you know, share with consumers or more fully flesh out. And one of the in-person types of approaches that we use is one that's called the food studio ideation. And that's an exercise where we bring in our clients, match them up with some of our creative team, and then really build to think. We're very much advocates of getting into the food itself as a way to actually create the ideas. And so what we'll do is we'll outfit a space in our offices that we call the food studio with hundreds, maybe thousands of ingredients. And then we'll actually build food models. And then those food models then, you know, get reported out and shared out as that first representation of the idea. So instead of a flip chart or a post-it note ideation, you know, we really advocate get into the food and really build to think. On the complete other end of the spectrum, we have another approach that we call proto-think, where, you know, sometimes, you know, getting creative on a Thursday afternoon isn't convenient for everybody. So it's a technology platform where, independent of time and independent of place, we can take teams, sometimes global teams, and bring them all together through a technology platform where we'll still lead a moderated discussion. And in these days where everybody's got a computer in their pocket, it's really incredible the rich discussions you can have, how you can share video, insights from the supermarket itself, and still, you know, pull all of that together in a real rapid way. So for us, you know, it's not one size fits all, but, you know, it's really understanding what that particular team needs and then being as hyper collaborative as possible and using the tools we have at hand to get to new, fresh ideas.
That's really neat. And I can imagine too, with the food innovation space that you set up, the studio, do you ever get like sensory overload with all of those ingredients in one spot?
Well, it's fun. You know, I think that's where it starts. I think, and you know, often that's where entrepreneurs and founders are starting too, is they're starting really close to the food itself and not up in their head and removed from it. So I think there's a lot of value in that act of actually building that first prototype or that first idea, just to express the idea. And then you go further from there, understanding some of the other nuances of the consumer proposition.
That's really, really neat. So Lenny, how does this same process work for pre-brands?
Well, we as kind of just with everything in our business, we come at it from a, you know, kind of pure consumer perspective, try to understand what consumers want. We do that through anything from kind of traditional quantitative and qualitative to field research. We do a lot of events, so we're talking to consumers all the time and, you know, just kind of in an informal environment, whether, you know, like yesterday, for example, we did an event in the grocery parking lot of a local grocer and probably got to interact with 1,000 consumers in an informal setting. And if you're in a position to really collect that feedback, I think you can learn some amazing things. But I think that for us, it starts with, you know, giving the consumer what they want. But I say like really giving them what they want and trying to draw a straight line between what the consumer wants and what we provide them. And I think that one of the challenges, and, you know, I don't envy larger companies for having this challenge, is that they can't quite come at it necessarily from a pure play perspective of giving consumers exactly what they want, because they have existing businesses and processes and brands and brand promises and, you know, positioning in the marketplace and, you know, God knows how many other things that they have to consider as they try to innovate for consumers. So they're probably smart enough to figure out exactly what consumers want. And then they kind of try to leverage their capabilities in whatever way they can to advantage themselves in addressing that consumer need. But it's sometimes hard to, you know, really address that organically and holistically, given that you come from, you know, an incumbent's and kind of legacy background versus, you know, a startup that doesn't have any of that, just basically can innovate to exactly what the consumer wants on their terms. And I think that's the difference. Is that's, I think, potentially what gives us an advantage, and I think is potentially a challenge for larger companies that want to do the same thing.
Right, and I totally agree. And I think some other people have touched on the fact that, you know, the nature of the startup business, you know, you're able to be maybe a little bit more nimble than perhaps a larger company, like you said. Natalie and Evan, in the same vein, are there certain practices that your organizations might encourage entrepreneurs to try in order to spark innovation?
Yeah, we try to find unique ways to get entrepreneurs out of their own headspace. Sometimes you get in your own way. And so one thing we encourage first and foremost is to get out of your space, get into any kind of trade shows, markets, events, network with the right community, become inspired by just walking down the supermarket aisles, but also to be sure to look at innovation that exists outside of the food and beverage industry. So sometimes you can really get inspiration by just walking into a furniture store or going to a clothing design place or looking at what they're doing with glass and metals and really exploring industries outside of just food and beverage. We've seen a lot of intersections lately with food, medicine, as well as food and beauty. And what's interesting is there's a lot of back and forth between beauty products that are starting to look more like food and food products that are starting to look more like beauty products. And so it's really great to try to find that inspiration by looking at what other industries are doing. And then just as mentioned before, is we always encourage them to think about the problem more than the solution, because if you can really convey the message of what problem you're solving, it makes it much easier to connect with your customer versus always focusing on a solution that doesn't necessarily solve any particular problem. So just thinking very carefully through it and seeing what makes the most sense.
So let me just add on a little here. Natalie actually mentioned it before, but one of the things that we've started to do in a much more significant way is try to engage with all the resources that we have with the entrepreneurs that are out there. So we actually do have a partnership with the Hatchery, and Natalie mentioned the event that we did with our culinology team, where we had roughly 60 folks in the room. The whole purpose of that event was really to get people to start thinking about how you can use ingredients in certain ways. And what we did was we shared a variety of different prototypes. So our team, we have a very large technical team, a large culinology team that, utilizes our ingredients, whether they're plant-based or for sugar reduction, in actual food prototypes that are generally on trend. And our culinologists are chefs. They're also food scientists, so they can mix that art and science together and show really cool things. And so it's not uncommon where, from an innovation perspective, we'll show different things. Our idea is we want to get people food in people's mouth to really spark ideas and spark that idea generation, for entrepreneurs, and how they can utilize the different ingredients that we have. And the reason why we have these ingredients is because we do look at the consumer trends. We do look at, plant-based is growing. So we have a variety of different pulse-based ingredients or pulse proteins and things of that sort. So when we want to spark entrepreneurial thinking, really it's about getting out in front of the entrepreneurs and make sure that they can see how they can use these things in a variety of ways. And it's always, I've worked with Mattson in the past as well. And I remember my one experience many, many years ago working with Mattson is, when you get in the lab and you get in the kitchen, many things can happen. And you talk to people and you get that feedback. So really getting food and beverages in people's mouth, and really trying to get them excited about how they can use, in our case, ingredients in a variety of different ways. So that's one of the things we've done. And again, we did that event very recently, actually right before the IFT event, and we're going to be doing more of those sorts of things in the future.
That's great. Yeah, it seems like there really needs to be a good mix of getting that hands-on experience, but also there's just a lot of other things to keep your finger on in terms of consumer perception and really the problems you're trying to solve, like you all mentioned. So that's really, really great insight. So a lot of startups have really started to embrace agility and rapid prototyping, which I think some of you have hinted to earlier in the conversation. And the question here really is directed to Lenny, but anyone, feel free to chime in. I'm curious as to how far along into the R&D pipeline would a company decide if a product should even go to market or if the idea should be taken in another direction or completely abandoned? And how many times do you really have to fail before you hit on something that's worth pursuing?
Yeah, so I mean, we're probably in a little bit of a different place in that. Number one, we're kind of a single ingredient product. With that, we're not having to kind of bring things to market that consumers are not already buying in some way. The question for us is, can we really bring something that's impactful to the segment for consumers that will allow us to kind of get rewarded for bringing that to market? And what's the size of the prize? So, we can bring just about anything to market, but if we bring it to market, does it actually make sense for the consumer? And then secondarily, does it also make sense for the retailer? One of the things that I've kind of learned here is that you could be an absolute bullseye from a consumer perspective, but if you're not generating sufficient contribution for the retailer on a revenue basis or gross margin or net margin basis, that product becomes unsustainable over time. So we found that, not only do we have to quickly figure out if consumers want to buy this, and we can figure out how much they're buying of that product today and how much benefit we bring to them by our approach, but then secondarily, how much volume do we think we can generate on this product for our customers, and will it be sustainable for them? And if we can answer yes to both of those questions, then it's something that we could pretty quickly bring to market and then just monitor on a kind of weekly or monthly basis and see what the kind of purchase and repeat and second repeat and ultimately loyalty to the product is. And if we're finding it's just not generating enough velocity, then we'll withdraw it from the market. So we've brought new products to market in the past that have worked, and we've brought some that have not. And we've learned from them, but I think it comes down to bringing something to market that consumers value enough and value it differently than current options for a product like our single ingredient that isn't really creating a new purchase or usage occasion. It's creating a higher price point and superior consumer benefit.
How about Natalie, Justin, and Evan, have you all had any experience with any of the startups that you've worked with in terms of kind of vetting their ideas before they hit the market and how, whether or not they know that they have the right sort of idea that's ready to move on to actually being scaled up and moved to market?
Yeah, this is Justin. For a lot of entrepreneurs, and even more and more these days for bigger companies, there's this move to launch to learn. So I think part of the trick here is, you know, how do you figure out how to take your idea far enough, but then use the marketplace itself as a way to get consumer guidance, consumer learning. In the old days, you know, often people would spend a ton of time isolated, you know, perfecting the product, and then later going to the marketplace and doing some big validation study. And I think more and more we just see people taking something that's, you know, minimally viable. Sometimes people use that word. I don't personally love that word, but I think it definitely does speak to the idea that, you know, the actual idea and concept itself, as well as the food product itself, can evolve. And being able to either go to consumers early in the process, and we can, you know, often we'll do that work here in a more controlled environment where we'll bring in, you know, a target consumer and really generate an early prototype. And then sometimes by the time we get to the second consumer group, we've actually iterated and pivoted and moved the product based on the feedback from the first group. And so we'll attempt to do that sometimes in a controlled setting. But I think other options are, you know, to go to the marketplace and learn from consumers and where, how are they voting with their dollars? It can be a little riskier in some ways, but I think, you know, there's definitely a movement in that direction.
This is Evan. One thing I just want to add here is I think that the retail landscape, and specifically the change with, you know, folks like Amazon, have changed the landscape. You know, it used to be where, you know, you have to go, you have to pitch the category manager. And obviously that's at a retailer, and that's obviously still something that's important. But, you know, there are entrepreneurs today that will start up and you ask them where are they distributing other than maybe a few local stores in, near where they are geographically. They have an online store and they're selling online. So that actually changes the game. You know, you don't have the gatekeeper necessarily, the retailer, as long as you have the capability to put something up online, assuming it's a more likely a shelf stable type product, which is easier, but you can still do frozen and other refrigerated products via, you know, via the web. It really, the shifting business model of retail, I think, changes how entrepreneurs are actually going to market as well. And it's something we really need to think about as well when you think about what does prototyping mean? Because, you know, it used to mean you have to get it on the shelf. Now it means, you know, you can literally launch something and as soon as you have it, you can put it online and you can sell it with a credit card.
Yeah. Or sometimes even with some of these crowdfunding approaches to the world, you sell it before you develop it, you know, which is really interesting. But yeah, I think Evan, you're exactly right. I think the paradigm in terms of how you actually sell products has changed, you know, how you develop those products.
Well, you know, one of the things I would say is, I think one of the evolutions is that it used to be that, you know, you could bring something to market and Whole Foods or the like would become a key proof point for whether, you know, a consumer segment wanted it. And what we're seeing more and more from retailers is that they're probably paying more attention to success on Amazon and consumer reviews on Amazon than any place else. So it's actually a great place to validate your proposition because it will enable you to have good conversations with brick and mortar customers should you choose to go in that direction.
Well, and sort of along that same line, so perhaps it's still a future technology, but online retailing, you know, is here. There's a lot of technologies coming in the future as well, such as blockchain, which there's a great episode of Food Disruptors about, 3D printing and machine learning. Like these also have similar potential for world and really market changing applications. So when we're looking at that larger market, are there any sort of initiatives out there that really excite you or that you see could really have that impact?
There are several, including the ones you just mentioned, but some of the innovations that I'm excited about in the food tech space, one being what Evan mentioned in terms of delivery right now. Recently, I just ordered a line of popsicles, and it's fascinating, first of all, what they can do in terms of shipping frozen products straight to your door. And then the quality of the product itself, because a lot of times it was hard to actually retain the quality in transition. So seeing a lot of that type of innovation and how products are getting right from the manufacturing space to your door, as well as reduction of that last mile challenge. So we're seeing a lot of, you know, self-driving cars and drones and all sorts of applications to get products into the consumer hands faster. And that's really important because convenience is king, and we see that continuing to grow. So anything around convenience, which also includes ordering technologies and applications, where we see a lot of more user-friendly applications and gamification. So ways that customers are ordering that's a little bit more engaging and gets them into the conversation, makes ordering a little bit more fun. That's been really exciting to see the progression of that moving forward. And also just technology and R&D around agriculture. It's nice to see that we're really starting to think carefully about soil health and getting nutrients back into the very ingredients for food. And we're looking at, you know, companies like Annie's, which launched, you know, unique product lines around soil rotation and crop rotation, and just trying to make sure that we're thinking about agriculture, because many of our companies here also are urban farmers. They have aquaponics and hydroponics facilities. So it's great to find unique ways to focus on seasonality in areas where maybe you wouldn't have been able to get certain crops year round. And now we can provide those nutritious foods to more people. So those are some of the areas that I'm most excited about.
I think it's really interesting, again, that you highlight just sort of the innovation across the whole even supply chain, from growing it to delivering it. There's just so much, there seems to be a lot of potential there.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is in a similar vein, but this whole idea of sort of how do you use food waste for ingredients, you know, the upcycled ingredients. And it's interesting to me that, you know, I think two or three of the IFT Next Food Disruption Challenge companies, including the one that I was a mentor for, were involved in that space. And I think we're, you know, Ingredion, we were looking at this before, you know, we got involved with IFT Next, but it's interesting how I'm seeing more and more of that. And I think, you know, the issue or problem of, you know, how do you utilize food and how do you utilize it completely is going to continue. And how do you, you know, there's always a waste stream, or often a waste stream off of production. So how do you utilize that? And are there valuable things that people can get out of that? Which is essentially what a lot of these types of companies are doing. You know, and there's this whole sustainability aspect around it. You know, when you think of sort of the consumer generation, millennials today, they want to know where their food's coming from. Why is it good for them? Is it healthy? You know, so, I mean, all the things around these sort of sustainable upcycled ingredients that can be utilized in food products, I think it's a very on trend and good story to tell, in addition to hopefully being good for you as well. So I think that's something I'm excited about. And, you know, I think it's an intriguing value proposition in the marketplace. I don't think anybody's hit it out of the park yet, because really it's a bunch of startups trying to figure it out. But I think you're going to see more and more of that in the future.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I feel like I've been hearing a lot of buzz about upcycling. So that's fascinating. Justin, how about you?
You know, taking a different direction, you know, an area that I'm just personally, but also professionally intrigued with is this area of personalized nutrition. And, you know, to me, it's linking together all of this data that we often now have on ourselves. So, you know, 23andMe or even Ancestry.com, we're going out and we're getting information about our genetic makeup. You can find out things about your microbiome, your food sensitivities, and then just even how you process food over time. Because, you know, while you have a certain set of genetics, you know, the 20-year-old you is not the same as the 30-year-old you and the 40-year-old you. And so I think taking all of this rich information that we have about ourselves, our activity, you know, that Fitbit that's on your wrist, and integrating it together in a really holistic way, you know, where you close the loop and solve problems for people. I'm just intrigued. There's a startup, and I know they're going through some, you know, kind of evolution, called Habit. And we never worked for them, but I was actually a user of their of their test, and then also some of their meal delivery that they were doing here in the Bay Area last year. And I just found the whole thing to be intriguing because really, in a very science-based way, they were trying to link together all of this information and then create a catered solution that, you know, when I tasted the food, I thought it was incredibly delicious. I think they're still trying to unlock how they figure out the economics of, you know, these food subscription and delivery services, because I think, you know, we've seen a lot of evolution in that space too. But, you know, folks that are really trying to take this quantified self type data and then turn that into solutions around food. For me, I think it's also something that no one's really truly figured out, but there's a lot of opportunity.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I feel like that's another one of those really hot items right now that people talk about a lot. And it's really cool to see some of it kind of coming to fruition like that. And Lenny, how about you? What are some of the future technology applications that you think have some potential to impact the food market?
Yeah, so I think that you know, one of the most interesting developments in food is the capital or sources of capital that are coming into the segment. And I would say that you're seeing you're seeing more of the kind of tech type investors that are investing in food. And I think what's interesting about that is that they are much more excited about disruption. They are comfortable with moonshot approaches to reinventing industries. And I think that what it's doing is it's giving license to entrepreneurs to kind of dream bigger and really push the envelope versus, I think, historically, there wasn't that kind of capital available and people had to be kind of more kind of shorter term in their mindset and maybe less aspirational. So I think that because that capital is coming to play and because they're seeing good returns and you're seeing large, let's call it nine figure, exits, sometimes even larger than that, that's basically giving that investment community optimism that they can make plays and invest capital and see 100x returns if they're right, recognizing that the vast majority of the time that they're not going to be. So I think that that's going to really, really change things as more and more capital becomes available and interested in moonshot approaches to large categories. I think you're going to see kind of innovation maybe that we've not seen before.
Absolutely. So let's take a look even further into the future. And really, I'm curious, having such great minds in this space present for the episode, I'm curious about your predictions for the next generation of food innovation. What do you think we're going to be seeing in the next 5 to 10 or even more years? Justin, how about you?
Yeah, Matt, thanks. I think when we look out, and especially we're looking out at a longer time horizon, like 5 to 10 years out, I think it's really important to start with who is that consumer in mind. And we've been so preoccupied with millennials over the last, few years that we still kind of have that language, but it's really going to be developing products for Gen Z. And so when we look out, I mean, Gen Z as a cohort is going to eclipse millennials in their buying power. And it's not far into the future. I mean, these older Gen Z consumers are now entering their 20s. And they're not just millennials on steroids. And I think the food industry is going to have to think a little bit harder and get a little bit more nuanced in their approach to Gen Z consumers. I think as it intersects with technology, really this consumer is the first true digital native. You know, they've grown up, they've never had a time where there hasn't been technology, and their primary way of interacting with the world from a technology perspective is not even through a computer, it's through their phone. And their expectations and just the fluidity by which they're going to use devices to interact with not just their foods, but with their lives, I think is going to continue to increase. I mean, while we've been sitting here on the on this podcast, I have an Amazon Echo on my desk and it's lit up a few times. I don't know what it heard, but it's always listening. And so a lot of the technologies that we have, are really borderline, I wouldn't call them virtual reality type of technologies, but augmented reality type of technologies where there's going to be a next step in terms of how you use some of this technology for really frictionless food experiences. And so I think that is something definitely to come. It's something that that new consumer is going to demand. I think the other dimension, though, of especially Gen Z type consumers that we can't forget is that we believe, and there's some research out there, that they're even going to be more conscious as consumers and even more engaged as citizens. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity for looking at this intersection of how this new consumer, this Gen Z consumer, who's going to be more important than ever and even more than millennials were, and then how they use technology and specifically augmented reality along with this kind of engagement approach to the world that they're going to take as citizens. So I think for us, it's really looking at that Venn diagram and how they all come together.
That's really interesting. And I have to say, as a millennial, I love the positivity and how you talk about it. I feel like I just read a headline that millennials killed mayonnaise. So I'm interested to see what Gen Z kills. But I think you're right. It's all about sort of the opportunity and adapting a little bit to these changing consumer needs and desires and experiences that they're looking for. Natalie, what's in your crystal ball?
Yeah, I completely agree with the augmented and virtual reality. I think that adds in another level of transparency where you can see things like a farm without being on the farm. On top of that, in the next 5 to 10 years, looking ahead, I think there's going to be a major focus on hyperfunctionality. We're seeing a lot of companies experimenting with CBD and cannabis, and I think that space is just going to skyrocket in the next few years. On top of that, I think there's going to be a lot of innovation around compostable packaging and finding more eco-friendly product lines. So it's going to be a kind of snack and stash where maybe you can eat your snack and the package that your snack is based in as well. So I can see a lot of that type of innovation coming to the forefront.
That's great. Lenny, what sort of innovations do you see on the horizon?
I alluded to this a little bit earlier, but I think that there's going to be an increasing focus on delivering taste in all these new products and new innovations. I'd say, you know, we became really good at kind of combining culinary and food science and creating great taste maybe unnaturally and in a processed way. And I think that, you know, consumers are now looking for kind of less processed, but I think still want all the sensory values that they expect from their foods. So I think that that's going to be a really big one.
I totally agree. And Evan, how about you?
I wish I had a crystal ball, but one of the things that I can tell you that I'm going to take a little bit of a look back, and then I think how do I apply that moving forward? And when I've sort of as a student of the industry, one of the things that I've seen is you know the CPG industry has been really ripe for innovation and disruption in categories that you never would have thought should have been disrupted. And I'll throw out things like popcorn or jerky. Right. You know, and look at these kinds of categories that suddenly became sexy again, suddenly became, innovative on trend. And I think it's for all the reasons that we've talked about today because of changing consumers. So I think it's going to be applying that sort of lens, given the generational shift, to a lot of the categories that are on the shelf today. And I think what I've seen is the really successful entrepreneurs are the ones who a lot of them are looking at categories that are out there and they're trying to think about how can they reinvent them. So I actually firmly believe, you know, in the next 5 years, 10 years, you're still going to have a supermarket. There's going to be other ways of delivery, whether it's via drone or Amazon or others. But I think the kinds of products on the shelf will have some glimmer of what they are today. But I think because of that shift, you're going to see entrepreneurs going after categories that are stayed and completely trying to disrupt them. You know, and we've seen that in categories now. And I think it's with good marketing, strong ingredient decks that appeal to the consumer, and a really good story as well. So that's what I would say. Maybe it's a little bit more general approach, but I think I've seen this time and time again over the last 10 years. And I think I'm going to continue. I think we will continue to see disruption of categories that, you know, we don't really think are that sexy, but somebody's going to come up with something really interesting in that category.
Fascinating. Yeah, well, I think that is a great place to leave it for today. Natalie, Lenny, Justin, and Evan, thank you so much for your time and your thoughts today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I'd also like to thank our listeners. If you're enjoying Food Disruptors, please let us know by leaving a review on iTunes or by connecting with IFT. You can find us at IFT on Twitter and by searching the Institute of Food Technologists on Facebook and LinkedIn. If you're interested in hearing more about food entrepreneurship, be sure to listen to our So You Want to Start a Food Startup episode, where you'll hear firsthand how other food-related startups got their start, how they scaled their businesses, and what the roadmap looks like for a successful food startup. Thanks for listening to Food Disruptors. I'm your host, Matt Teagarden. Have a great day, everyone.